is give a little introduction first.
Okay.
This is Barry Tyker of the Oral History Project. Today is October 14th, 1993. I'm in the Red Gym with Nancy Abraham, and we're going to talk about her career at the UW. Nancy, why don't you start out by talking a little bit about your early childhood and your early education?
I was born in Sheboygan, Wisconsin in 1934, actually October 13th, so this is one day after my 59th birthday. I was an only child. My mother was very ill, so I have memories of sometimes needing to take care of her and sometimes having neighborhood children come in, that is, you know, teenagers to help, and my father having to do a lot of housework, that kind of thing, after he'd come home from work. I guess it wasn't until I came to the university that I realized that I came from a lower socioeconomic family and a blue-collar family. I was one of those people who really loved school. I thought there was nothing more exciting than going to school every day, and I loved it through my entire elementary education and high school education.
And you went in Sheboygan for those?
Not only did I go to school in Sheboygan all of my growing up years, I went to one school for 11 years.
Why?
Because we had 2 years of kindergarten. It was actually rather far-sighted, I think. We entered in afternoon kindergarten for a year, and then the next year we went to morning kindergarten. And so that was all in the same school from first year of kindergarten through ninth grade. And then I went on to Central High in Sheboygan.
Did you have any particular teachers, or was there anyone in your family that instilled a feeling toward education for you?
I certainly can emphasize the importance of my first grade teacher. In fact, I'm still in correspondence with her.
Oh, really?
Annually, sometimes more than once a year, but always at Christmas time. It was her first year of teaching when I and others were in that first grade class, and she was just wonderful. And so it was really fun to have someone like that. And that was also a time and place where teachers visited homes. So she would visit various homes and come for lunch maybe, or stop by after school. So there was a lot of connection, as I recall it, between home and school. So certainly I think she had an impact. And then there were high school teachers that had a lot of impact.
Let's talk a little bit about high school. Where were your interests starting to develop at this point? Or is it still?
That's been very difficult. I'm still too young to know what all of my interests are, even at 59. But I was in the college, quote-unquote, college track in high school, and I liked everything. It was really hard to know what I didn't like. I was shy. People at the university would find that hard to believe now. But I would say that a history teacher who was also a debate and forensics instructor had a lot of impact, in that the history classes that he taught were very challenging. We at that time were very annoyed by him because he seemed to be so demanding, but in retrospect it was really good training because he taught us to question and to not be afraid to question. And another thing, he was the debate and forensics coach, and he sort of buttonholed people in the hallway to say, I think you should be on the debate team, or I think you should be involved in forensics. I didn't think I should be, but he was sort of intimidating, and so I became part of the debate and forensics teams, and I think that was a really excellent learning experience.
Why didn't you think you should have been involved?
I was too shy, but he soon worked that out of me.
So that was one of the, maybe that was one of the reasons that you were able to overcome that shyness?
I think so, because we really had to be prepared for every debate tournament, and we had to be prepared for different forensic activities, and you had to learn to stand up in front of a fair number of people and be judged on what you were arguing or debating about or what you were speaking about. So I see that as one of my single most important learning experiences in my life as I look back on it.
Did you travel around like the county or the community for these debate societies?
We traveled around the state to a certain extent. I've long since forgotten the places we went to, but I remember one of the debate questions was, of all things, McCarthyism.
Oh, my.
And that was back in the early 50s. Again, I can't remember all the arguments, but I remember that that was a very interesting area to pursue and one that I didn't know a whole lot about at the time, but we had to do research on it. I think that was another thing. Whenever you were debating, you had to do research on the topic or topics that you were involved in. And that really sort of satisfied an ongoing interest that I've had in research. I've always enjoyed that. I don't know if I'm particularly good at it, but I recognize it as a very important aspect and something that I can get pretty excited about.
Out of curiosity, Scheugen is not that terribly far from Appleton. Was there support? Do you remember there being support for McCarthy?
As I recall, there would have been support for McCarthy, because there are aspects of the Scheugen community that have been that were conservative and remain quite conservative, but I can't remember the details anymore. But I remember people being in support of McCarthy. That I remember.
What about tracking? How did you get into the upper track? Do you recall?
I think at that time it was a matter of the school system or the principal and the teachers looking at how students were performing and sort of saying, I think you look like potential university or college material, and I think these are courses that would be good for you to take. Because already as freshmen, many of us were taking algebra and then geometry, and you know, by I think the sophomore year, chemistry. And I do remember being one of about four young women in high school who took physics. Primarily that was a course that only young men took, but there were four of us in the physics class. And there was just one physics class, as I recall. There may have been more, but that was the only one I was aware of in our high school.
When did you start to realize that maybe you were interested in going on to college, or that you could go on to college, or however that decision came about?
That's an interesting question, because coming from quote-unquote a lower socioeconomic family and having no family members on either side of the family in any generation, to my knowledge, who had ever gone on to higher education, it wasn't really an expectation in my family. Yet I wasn't discouraged from taking the courses I was taking in high school. So that was an interesting phenomenon. And I remember telling my father that I was going to be wanting to go to college. And I remember his Germanic fist coming down on the table saying, you know, what does a girl want going to college? All she does is grow up and get married. And I was pretty determined, so I just never discussed it again. And proceeded to check into scholarships and proceeded to apply to Stout, then Stout Institute. And the reason I did that was because I was very interested in foods and design and clothing, and had learned through a college night at our high school that that was a well-respected institution for those kinds of interests. So then, after I graduated from high school, later in the summer, I simply announced one night at supper that I would not be there in the fall. You know, I would be gone. And so, well, where was I going? And I said I was going to Stout. So that was how it happened.
And that was accepted, that decision was then accepted.
Well, there was not a whole lot that could be done then, because it was an accomplished fact. And then they did drive me to school, you know, they did, and they actually gave me a bit of money at that point. I guess they realized I'd made up my mind and everything was in place, and I went. So that's...
Before we get to Stout, let's go back to your teachers
sure.
at Scheugen for just 1 minute. Did they encourage you to pursue a higher education?
Yes, they did, yeah.
Was there any problem with the fact that A, you were a woman, and B, you came from a lower class family?
I never sensed any of that in any interactions with teachers or in any of my coursework. That, I mean, as I said earlier, it wasn't until I came to the University of Wisconsin and was enrolled in some sociology courses that I realized, quote unquote, from whence I had come, so to speak. And I guess I never thought about the fact that I couldn't or shouldn't go on to school. And I feel we had a very supportive environment in school. And maybe that was only for students who were sort of being tracked. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But as I look at my own personal experience, I have only positive feelings about school. And just that I really liked it a lot.
What about, let's go to Stout now. Mm-hmm. How did you pay for that?
I paid for Stout both through money I had earned and saved, you know, in my senior year in high school and working in the summer at a resort, and by some part-time work while I was at Stout that freshman year. And then I had some scholarships. I forget what those are called. They used to be called like the legislative scholarships, mm-hmm. or something.
I think that's what they were called.
And I had also gotten another scholarship or so when I graduated from high school. I had done well mm-hmm. in high school, I don't know, among the top few in a mm-hmm. class of about 350 students.
Oh, that's
a
good class.
Huh? So I did have scholarships, and things were not as expensive then. Mm-hmm. So by putting everything together, plus that little windfall of some money from my father and stepmother, which I had not planned on, it was possible to go off for my first year.
Now, you were there for
one year, in fall of 53.
Anything that stands out in your mind about that year at Stout?
It was lots of fun in many ways, but it was also a very small environment. Mm-hmm. There were like about 750 students, whereas I had graduated from a high school which had about 1,600 mm-hmm. students. So it was, and it was a small town, mm-hmm. and very, in a sense, provincial. I have this one image of walking down the street one day and seeing a driver of a vehicle open his car door, and that was a signal that he was going to make a turn onto another street. I mean, so it was very interesting.
That's great.
Yeah, and I remember that the year that I was there, a new library was built at Stout, and so all of the students and staff were involved in literally moving the books and other equipment from the old library, which was probably in like Old Main or something like that, to a new facility. And I just remember enjoying it a lot and doing well academically and working. Mm-hmm. So,
did you take your textile courses in your freshman year? Was it just introductory English and things like that?
It was English and psychology, but it was also nutritional kinds of things. And I think there must have been some textile clothing-related course and speech. It was general as well as some specific. And at that time, I have no idea what's done now, but at that time at Stout, as a freshman, you also in that program needed to take a combination physiology-anatomy course, mm-hmm. as an example. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, that was my first experience with a poor animal, namely a cat.
You didn't do frogs in high school?
I guess we did do frogs, actually, in junior high. But a cat is a lot bigger than a frog. You know? And you had to go through that process with a team member of literally skinning the cat, mm-hmm. so to speak, before you began to work on its cadaver. So that was a different experience, but we did it, you know.
What happened at the end of the year that
made you stop? I continued to work, and then I was married, and that's what brought me to the university. So my sophomore year was at the university.
Of Wisconsin, here in Madison.
Here at Madison, yes. And I continued in the home economics program, but became probably among the first of the female students enrolled to become pregnant while enrolled. And that was another interesting experience, because the Student Health Center was not really prepared to do tests to determine whether
was
indeed.
That's interesting.
So one had every other condition but pregnancy.
And now, this was in about 1955, right?
Yeah, 54, 55, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so that was interesting. There were a few other people I knew who were in similar circumstances, and we sort of had to demand of the health center a test to affirm or deny our pregnancy. But, I mean, that was a time where the University of Wisconsin-Madison, I don't know about other places, wasn't really ready for that yet. And that was a hard year for a lot of reasons, but this is an area that, of course, most men you're interviewing would never be talking about, but I was very ill from the pregnancy, and so I was determined I wasn't going to drop one single course. I mean, I paid my money, and I was going to finish my courses. That was hard to do in the spring semester. Mm-hmm. And so I felt very fortunate that one of the design courses I had, as an example, I just explained to the instructor exactly what my situation was. And so I was able to do most of my design work outside of the laboratory and then bring it in periodically, you know, for review and critiquing and so on. But probably the hardest course was biochemistry, because if anyone has ever been involved in laboratories where we're dealing with organic matter, the odors are horrendous, and they're especially so
when you're pregnant.
And I was determined not to drop that course. It was too critical to the program. And so I kind of had it all figured out that if I ran into the laboratory, worked with my partner to get everything set up, and then, you know, time X would have elapsed, and I'd have to just dash out of the lab to the nearest restroom, come back, and finish up the experiment.
Oh my. And,
so those were interesting times. I mean,
were the professors pretty
actually, when you consider the time, you know, 1955, the spring, yes. Because I remember talking to the biochemistry professor and saying I didn't think I could make a lot of the lectures, but that I knew someone who could take the notes, that was acceptable. And then, of course, I made almost every laboratory and the discussion section. So that's how I didn't go through that course with flying colors, mm-hmm. but I did accumulate a fair amount of information, and I did pass the course with a C. Mm-hmm. I didn't like getting a C, but I was determined to complete the course.
It's interesting what you said earlier about how the health service was so unprepared for you, because certainly the university must have had students get pregnant over time.
Yeah.
And did they just try to sweep these unwanted or unmarried pregnancies under the carpet?
Well, it felt like they were doing that, because there were other friends of mine who were also married, who were also pregnant on campus at that time, but I think our numbers were rather low in the early 50s, early to mid 50s.
So it was just essentially a problem of them not being prepared for you, not giving you a hard time. Or
no, it was like, oh no, that can't be. It must be hepatitis. It must be. I mean, we had passed through the era of GIs returning to campus, mm-hmm. but primarily those people were male. Mm-hmm. There would have been some female, but I think this was like entering another era mm-hmm. of women on campus who were married. Mm-hmm. There had been women on campus, certainly, but usually not married, probably, if one were to look at the data. So that was kind of the front end of what is now just very common.
It was uncommon,
yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's very interesting.
Oh, it was. As I say, it's different from what many others might
yes,
be
that's right.
might be reporting, but it's how it was.
Now, you were out of school then for 5 years, was it?
Yeah, I was, let's see, from about 55 until the fall of 1960.
And what was it that compelled you to re-enroll? Was it here in Madison?
It was, again, at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and it was sort of the cutting edge of what we see a lot of today. I was divorced in that interim, and the reality of needing to support myself and my son, and to be able to do that in a way that would mean a life that was more comfortable rather than a constant struggle economically. So again, I was sort of on the front edge of that. And I think from the perspective of the university's history in general, I'd like to just share what I encountered when I decided to return to the university. By then, people like Catherine Clarenbach were working to help women return to campus, but the numbers, again, were still pretty small. And I remember when I applied for what was then called the National Defense Education Act loan, the financial aid office on the Madison campus did not know whether they could give me that loan. And I asked them why not after I'd submitted my application. They said, well, such a large portion of your budget is designated for childcare that we're not sure we can give you. And I said, well, what difference does it make what the money is designated for if that's what one needs in order to be able to return to school? Well, they didn't know whether they could do that. And so I said, well, you know, if I don't receive it, I will need to appeal that decision. You know, I'll need to file some kind of appeal or grievance or whatever because I don't understand the rationale. Well, I did get the loan, and I didn't need to appeal. So,
did you find out if there was any kind of a grievance process? Or?
I don't think there was, but I was ready to do it.
Ready to make one.
So I did get the loans, and those were a couple of hard years returning to the university while working half-time, while raising a young child. But I did it, and I'm glad I did. It was, in some ways, it was easier than the year I was pregnant.
That's right. The odors of the biochem.
Yeah.
Did you stick with your textile work then?
I stuck with home economics and with education. Because I thought, well, education would be a good arena in which to work. But when I actually did my student teaching, I found how difficult it was. And I really questioned of myself whether I could handle both that and raising a young child at a time when there weren't very many supports available for women to be doing both of those things. And so, when I did finish my degree, I continued work in the medical school. I did not instantly enter a quote-unquote professional arena, but rather stayed in the medical school, which was more comfortable, a little bit safer. I mean, I'm not, in one way I'm not a risk taker, in another way I guess I am, and I was sort of looking at, well, I do have a position, I do have my degree, now I need to see what I'm going to do next. So I continued in the medical school for about 2 years after I had gotten my bachelor's degree.
Before we get into a little bit about your home ec training here,
sure.
Let's talk about your job in the medical school. Mm-hmm. When did you get that and what essentially was your job?
Well, I had initially begun work in the Historical Society in about 57, I guess. And that was going to be temporary. That was going to be while my husband finished a degree here at the university, an advanced degree. And then of course, as I'd mentioned earlier, I was divorced. So then the work became not temporary, but a permanent kind of thing. But I had entered state service at a very low rank. I mean, the lowest. You couldn't start any lower in clerical work. And there was really no place to go at that point in the Historical Society. So then I moved down to the medical school. I had learned from someone with whom I was working that there was a clerical secretarial job opening in the medical school business registrar's and dean's office. And so I applied for that and accepted that position. And it was while I was working in that position that I also went back to the university. So I went to school full-time and worked half-time. And at that time, you had to be attending full-time at the university in order to receive a national defense loan. You could not receive one through part-time enrollment at that time. So that really made it a challenge.
Where was the med school? Was that in the old hospital at that point?
It was in the 1300 University Avenue, the old university hospital, and the registrar and business office was in an old house next to the former nurses' dormitory. That has long since been destroyed.
Where was the former nurses' dormitory? Well, that's something I don't know about.
Well, that's where one of the ROTC units is now located on University Avenue in Randall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that had formerly housed nursing students. It was their dormitory. Yes. Uh-huh. So then this old house right behind it on Randall was the medical school's business office at that time. And that's where I landed for about 3.5 years.
Now you're talking about that old house like it doesn't exist anymore.
It doesn't. It was razed, you know. I think it's a parking lot now. Yeah. Uh-huh.
So you were finishing your home ec here. Any comments about the home ec department? Any particular individuals in the home ec department that stand out in your mind for one reason or the other?
Well, among the professors I had as an undergraduate was Rita Humans, and I really appreciated her as a professor then. One of the things that she emphasized a lot was, what are you giving back for what you have gotten, kind of thing. And I think I'd been raised that way, but it really became ingrained in me and sort of became part of who I am, that if I'm part of something, I really feel a responsibility to be giving back as well as taking from. And that was certainly a philosophy that I remember her emphasizing a lot, and I respected her for that and obviously picked up on that a lot also. Other instructors I don't remember as well because I was involved in this extreme regime of trying to keep two bodies and souls alive as well as... But I can remember what I think is an interesting and amusing sort of situation. Back then, even in the early 60s, the home management house, which was part of the home economics program, was still in existence and being used as a laboratory, as it were, for home economics students. Well, I explained that I didn't think I could really live in that house since I had this child I was also raising. So I remember I got a dispensation from that, and then I needed to do special projects in lieu of that experience of being in the home management house.
I've never heard of anyone getting a dispensation from that.
I did.
Project.
I did.
Who was it who ran that house? I can't remember.
Oh, I wish I could think of her name right now.
Yeah, it just slips my mind.
It's slipping my mind right now also.
What about your experiences with the School of Education? Is there any person in there or any event or situation that you recall as being?
I think I recall better when I worked on my master's degree. I can't think of any people in particular right now that...
Okay.
James Lipham was one of the professors I had in education at that time, and I believe he's now deceased, is he not? Yeah.
He died 6 years ago.
Yeah. And again, I remember I kept having to get special dispensations.
But basically, the university was flexible enough to do that?
I think it was. I mean, I think I must have presented my case well, and I think they must have realized that I would do the independent, what it really amounted to in lieu of the home management house was some independent work with a report that then needed to come back. And then, well into my senior year, second semester, I was informed that I was one credit short from graduation. And so what to do? I mean, I wasn't about to go through another summer school or whatever. So I did find a professor in education whose name escapes me, because really he saved my life. Although maybe I saved his too, because he had a lot of research that needed to be done in studies revolving around behavior modification and behavior management and so on. And so I spent a lot of time in the stacks digging out studies and abstracting them for him, research studies that were already in the literature, and then doing abstracts and presenting those to him for work that he was doing. So it was almost doing low-level graduate student work while earning one credit while being able to finish my degree that semester rather than going on further. So that was really a special dispensation also, but I worked for it. I mean, it wasn't just handed to me.
You've answered several of the questions already, this question already with several of your examples about your special dispensations, but were there any other problems or whatever that came up because of your more or less adult status pursuing an undergraduate. Was that a very unusual thing to do at that point?
It was semi-unusual. I think, again, we were just at the fringes of seeing more women in particular coming back or starting the university who had families or whose families were grown. Because I remember a few other people in classes in home economics who were returning either to work on master's degrees or to finish bachelor's degrees that they had not completed. But there were not large numbers of us. I don't think that I really encountered problems as such from the university. I think it meant that my educational experience was very different from my first year, in that I certainly was not a member of any student organization or organizations. I really wasn't engaged in any social kinds of activities with other students. There just wasn't time. It was, I am here to do this, and I need to get it done, and I feel I need to get it done within 2 years and a summer, which
so your,
I did.
So your extracurricular activities were basically going home and cooking and
yes,
raising
right,
your,
right,
your family
right. And running to the library at Saturday mornings or Saturday afternoons and doing the required reading, I mean, like a machine, just because you knew you had 5 hours to do this and get it done and take notes as fast as you could and that kind of thing, yeah.
So at this point, we have you working, you've graduated with your degree, you're not sure about the teaching aspect of it, and you're still working in the medical school business office in that. He's the first Nobel guy I ever had. Yeah. So you're going back for your master's degree now.
Yes,
and still working in.
Yeah, actually, I worked in the medical school for 5.5 years. 3.5 of those years in the registrar, dean's, and business office, and then I worked for 2 years in hematology research, which was interesting. I mean, it was an opportunity to utilize a lot of the scientific nomenclature and so on that I had acquired as a part of my education. So normally, probably a sub-department in a medical school is not finding someone who comes in to type and file and recall patients who has a fairly good background in science, which I definitely had. But then after a couple of years of that, it was really time to think about other activities. So I started looking around and accepted a position with Jack Helsvig in what was then called the Office of High School Relations and worked there from 1964, I think it was, until 1967 when I did return to work on a graduate degree. And that was lots of fun, interesting, exciting. I got to know many more people on campus because we scheduled many, many high school visits out around the state, and that's part of what I did.
Yeah, tell me what the Office of High School Relations is exactly.
Well, it was new at that time, about 1 year old, and it was an effort on the part of the Madison campus, and Milwaukee also had a similar office, to reach out to the high schools in the state of Wisconsin, perhaps differently from what the campuses had been doing prior to that in a very concentrated, concerted effort. So it was everything from Jack Helsvig going out to visit principals and counselors in high schools to our coordinating staff from around the campus, professors, academic staff, to be available at college days or career days or career nights. So it was kind of like running a booking agency of coordinating visits to all parts of the state. High School Relations also became involved with the Junior Science, Engineering, and Humanities Symposium, which still goes on now. And it's connected with the Mathematics Research Center out of Duke University, I believe, at Durham, North Carolina. So that was to, and still is, to encourage young people to get involved in scientific areas and to work on research projects in high schools and then submit those projects for consideration. And then the six best students, at least at that time and maybe still today, were brought into the symposium to present their papers. I mean, other people were also invited. And then also they were able to attend the National Junior Science, Engineering, and Humanities Symposium, which was held at places like West Point or Princeton, various places like that, and then would have an opportunity to meet with other young people from around the country who were interested or perhaps really very talented in science and math and engineering. So those were some of the kinds of things that were going on then.
We'll talk about it later when we get into your summer session years, but I could certainly see how that experience would be helpful later on in terms of being a coordinator and
I thought so.
Pulling all this stuff, all this material together. What specifically was your job function, or can be
In high school relations?
Yeah, in high school relations.
Well, initially it was an administrative assistant and then assistant director. So it was kind of a move up.
And where was this facility located?
At that time it was in the A.W. Peterson building.
Huh.
Yeah, and initially it was part of the Registrar and Undergraduate Admissions Office. Then I think it split out at some point, and now under a slightly different name, it's again at this point in 1993 part of Undergraduate Admissions.
Did you think the program did what it was supposed to do?
I think it did. I think at that time the Madison campus staff, of which there were two of us, was clearly overworked.
Mm-hmm.
Because our responsibilities were basically the state as a whole. It seemed, if I'm remembering correctly, that at that time Milwaukee's responsibilities were more within the proximity of Milwaukee. Yet we had a staff about half the size. We were really moving. We were working hard. We did then get a secretary, and we're moving to get other staff at about the time that I decided to return to graduate school. But yeah, I think we were doing what we understood our mission to be, trying to quote-unquote articulate with the high schools in the state of Wisconsin about the University of Wisconsin-Madison, what it had to offer, what their high school students could expect to encounter if they came to campus as new freshmen or as transfer students. Yeah, I think we were doing what we thought we were supposed to do.
One question before we go to your master's program. You said the director was Jack
Kelsvig.
Kelsvig, can you tell me anything about him, what kind of a director he was?
Jack is probably one of the most straightforward, straight arrow, honest, good people that I've encountered. I mean, I think he's done his job with good humor through many years. He is still in that position.
Oh, my.
Yes. Well, actually, 30 years later, because that office as such was started in 1963. And I think, as with every one of my bosses, there was always the interesting phenomena of male and female. And I think you can see that given my background, I had to do a lot of things alone. So I was used to and was expecting to be able to stand on equal ground. And sometimes that was a problem. Maybe it was my problem sometimes. But my life experiences and my educational experiences prepared me for that. Even back to when my father said, girls do not go to college. And I just went anyway. So I mean,
so that was the start of
which
was really something that you would encounter pretty much.
And I think it's just the time we're in, in you know, the 20th century and where we're moving to. So,
but
I really think Jack has been a good person for that role and that position. Another of the things that has been part of that for years is the summer orientation and advising program for new freshmen and new transfer students. So I was involved in that also during the years that I worked with Jack.
Let's go to your MA, your decision to come to Madison, or to pursue, you were still in Madison this whole time, of course, to pursue your MA. What brought that about?
Well, again, it was sort of an economic decision and a self-determination decision, which seems to have to do with a lot of my decisions.
There are certain patterns that I'm seeing emerging here very clearly, yes.
And it became very evident to me that I would not be able to move beyond where I was without additional degrees, and both economically or otherwise. And so I really thought about what do I enjoy most? What would I really like to do graduate work in? And maybe it wasn't the long view, but it was certainly where I was at that point. And I really decided I wanted to pursue a graduate degree in textiles and design. Textiles had always been part of my life. I mean, even in high school, I'd been the costume designer and chair for major projects that went on, like the talent shows or some of the plays, where I actually coordinated many, many other students who were seamstresses, who were, you know, under sort of my quote-unquote direction. So it was a natural. And I love those 2 years that I was enrolled in the graduate program in textiles and design. I had a chance to pursue some special projects, both in, pre-Inca history, the Tiwanaku'ayd period in the highlands, and had a chance to get a better understanding of what was really going on in that part of the world through my special project work. And I implemented a program for young children in the Marquette-Wilmar neighborhood in Madison, children who had a lot of difficulty in school, but I had a strong belief that the crafts would be a vehicle for interaction and that in the process we could come to some level of communication. So that was basically my master's thesis work. And that took me again to a lot of research, not only within the United States, but in other countries, including work that had been done in Hurania, Egypt, when youngsters were taught how to weave, but really not to design. And the feeling was that in that process, their creative energies would be would really come forth. And then an interesting offshoot of that project in Hurania was that women who had absolutely no status and no, really no economic basis at all, were beginning to sell their weavings. And they suddenly found themselves in a different relationship to men in their mm-hmm. village mm-hmm. because now they had they had bakshish, they had money, and therefore some level of clout. Well, anyway, these are the kinds of tangential or interrelated things that always fascinate me when I get involved in any kind of project. So I did do my master's. I did complete it, but by then I was working in summer sessions as a graduate assistant.
So you had already started out at that point.
Yes. The second year in my graduate program, I started work with Clay Shainfelt.
Well, before we get into that, preface that by asking, had it occurred to you as you were doing these very interesting projects, what you were going to be using your MA for? Did you have a specific goal in mind?
See, this is where I sound really ridiculous, Barry.
Well, we all need to sound really ridiculous at some time or other. So.
I didn't have a specific goal. I had my specific goal of pursuing this graduate work, which was an absolute delight to me. I think, you know, you keep hearing that refrain that I really like school, I really like research, all of those kinds of things, and that growth process of opening up sort of another arena of my life. It was so much easier than when I finished my undergraduate work, because my son was older, he was more independent, and it was fun, you know, to be working with color and design and the history of textiles, which, again, if one pursues that, pretty much gives you a background on the history of the world, you know, if you really look at it that way. So, no, I didn't know exactly what I might do or might not do. I just knew that I wanted to do that. And I did it, and I've never regretted it. But I've not, quote-unquote, used it a whole lot.
Well, sometimes Joseph Campbell's the one who says, follow your bliss. Maybe that was what...
Well, it was wonderful. It was just, yeah. You know, it was a wonderful experience.
Were there any teachers or any people here at the university in that wonderful part time of your life who we would like to mention?
Well, I really enjoyed Pat Mansfield as an instructor. She's younger than I, and I think she was in her early years of instructing at that time, but she had such a flair and such a knowledge of design and color that it was really, really fun to be in her textile design course that involved a lot of the printing techniques as well as the design techniques. Till Schwalbach, to me, is just one of the wonderful people that... I think we were really fortunate to have her within the School of Family Resources. She has since retired.
What did she teach?
She taught a variety of design courses, and it was actually, she was actually the head of my master's committee. And she was very open, you know, to new ideas and to students doing what they wanted to do. I don't mean unrelated to anything within the program, but she could listen to ideas and perceive what a student was trying to communicate. And in that way, I'm saying, then be able to help one sort of focus their energies. And it was she who really helped me with the project at Marquette Wilmar. And there were others who couldn't see the value of that, but she could, you know, after hearing about it. I just think she was one of the most gracious people. I mean, I felt really honored to know her. And then, of course, Bert Kreitlow from Education. I had just one adult ed course in my master's program. And again, I wanted to do that because I wasn't quite sure where I would go with all of this, but I felt that it was important to have a course in adult education. Of course, it became very important with summer sessions. There was and special students, that became sort of my foundation, actually. And he was an interesting character. He had a way of really engaging students in a class because he had all sorts of techniques that he used.
Like what?
I'm trying to think. I mean,
think
I wish I could. I mean, they weren't even techniques sometimes. They were gimmicks.
Tricks.
Yeah, right. They were gimmicks and tricks. Maybe one will come to me as we go along, but his approach in the adult education class was to have, and almost all of us were adults, I mean returning adults of one sort or another from various parts of the country, was to have team projects. So you were actually doing what you would probably be doing if you were involved in teaching adults. You wouldn't just be lecturing at them, you would be engaging a group of adults in a project so that they could interact. So that was a big part of what he did. And it was interesting. You did get to know students, you know, fellow students in a hurry, and you really had to rely on one another for the projects to be completed, you know. You had to learn how to keep others engaged who didn't seem quite as willing or able to pursue the end goal.
Don't they do that in high school now? They take these
kids
out of the woods and they
learn
to rely on them.
Yeah, you have to remember we're talking still the late 60s. But you know, I don't know if it's appropriate here, but having been a student here in 54, 55, and then in 60 to 62, and again, 67 to 69, I really saw a distinct change in students and how they viewed education, at least from my perspective, I
Please
saw.
Comment.
Well, I mean, I was really taken aback by the time I got into my graduate program of students talking about psyching out the professor. You know, what is it he wants or what is it she wants? And of course, coming from my background and my perspective, I think, who cares what they want?
Yeah.
I mean, aren't I here to learn? And if this is what I think is appropriate, based on the assignment that's been given, then this is what I'm going to do. I mean, I'm not going to spend my energy trying to psych out the professor. But that was a very, from my perspective, a very distinct change that I had.
Yeah, I would think so. Yeah.
I had not seen that in the 50s at all. Maybe people were doing it and not talking about it then. I mean, there's always that. And I didn't really see that in the early 60s, at least the courses in which I was enrolled. But I really saw it by the late 60s a lot.
Any theory that you have, having experienced both sides of it as to why?
Well, I think students have always been interested in good grades, but I think it was getting more and more to a point where if you didn't get really, really good grades, how were you going to get a job? I mean, that was always a concern of students, but it just seemed to take a different twist that was hard for me to incorporate into my own philosophical framework. And I'm still not able to incorporate that into my philosophical framework.
Probably there's an educational psychologist writing about it even as we speak.
Maybe so, but that was something that I really could see that had changed a lot on our Madison camps and probably everywhere.
Now, it's interesting in that you said you were taking this wonderful two-year master's program and something that you didn't know what it was preparing for you. And at the very same time, you ended up being an assistant the second year in what turned out to be your career.
Yes.
It's funny how those two things work together, as it seems like they sometimes always do.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
Before we get into your summer sessions, which is really going to be the focus of most of the rest of this interview, we left one person kind of sitting back in Sheboygan, and that was your father,
who
reluctantly sent you off to college. Yeah. Let's visit dear old dad for a moment and get his reactions to how things developed for you.
It was interesting because I did not live with my father all of my growing up years. After my mother died when I was about 8, I lived with an aunt and uncle and cousins. So we were in contact, but it wasn't a daily living situation. And then I returned to live with him when he remarried. So it was like growing up in three different families. Yes, he did drive me to college, and when I returned as an undergraduate, when my son was young and I was divorced, he did give me some money, and he said at that point, education is very important. Mm. I mean, and you know, if you're going to really make a decent living today and have a fairly decent life. So it was interesting to see how he had really modified his views. And while he didn't ever say, well, I'm sorry, he was acting on what he had known and how he had grown up and the milieu through which he had come. But he was also able to see things were beginning to change in this society. And I'm sure it was very hard for him, his only child, his only daughter, to be divorced. That was something that had never happened, you know, in the family. But I think given everything, he came along pretty well, maybe better than many people might, even well-educated people, perhaps. And then when I went to graduate school, he just handed me $500. I mean, not that money is the... It was just a reflection of how his perspective had altered. And the recognition that, yes, this is a different time. Women are not necessarily always at home. Although he didn't articulate that. That was, you have to kind of look at the old German sort of.
Yeah, those German men, I come from a German family.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is their way of expressing changed viewpoints, don't you?
Yeah.
I mean,
it seemed
that way to me.
Yeah.
Seemed that way to me. So yes, and then he and my son were very, very close. He was a very important element in my son's life, and real important in the last years that he was alive when my son was so ill. So that was another opportunity for a dyed-in-the-wool old German to really come to terms with things that have not been easy for people to come to terms with in this society. The place of women, you know, in the work world and elsewhere, and then the whole arena of mental illness. And so he really believed in my son and said, you're going to make it. So I thought that was very interesting.
Let's just Let's talk for just one moment, if we can. We talked about your father a couple of times. Let's talk about your mother for just a moment or two.
Sure. As I mentioned, my mother died when I was about just short of 9, but I do remember her very well. I remember when she was able to be up and around that she did really neat, creative kinds of things. Like she made beautiful cakes. At Easter, she made lamb cakes with gorgeous decorations. And for birthday parties, she always had interesting favors. And, you know, she decorated the table very nicely. And she also made clothing, both for my dolls and for me. And I remember some of the embroidery work on some of the clothing. In fact, one dress I still have. The only reason I have it is because when I was cleaning out my dad's house after he'd gone to a nursing home, I'd often wondered what had happened to this white dress with the pink and blue embroidery. And there it was, washed and starched and ironed and packed away in a little box. And I suppose it was a memory for him, and it was certainly a memory for me. So I do remember her having a real creative bent. And I remember my aunt, well, she still has a creative bent, the one with whom I lived. And she's done lots of embroidery and oil painting and quilts by the drove. Mm. Every member of the family has one or several, and they are all gorgeous. So that both with my mother and my aunt, the area of textiles was, I think, a fairly important part of who they were and what they did, and maybe that, I don't know.
And subsequently, maybe who you.
Yes, maybe so. Yeah, maybe so.
We're picking up a few pieces that we missed earlier that we talked about when we took a short break. You also said you wanted to talk a little bit about the bean fields.
Yes, I don't think an interview of my life is complete without that. Growing up in Sheboygan, on the edge of the city, we were working in the bean fields when we were young children, picking beans. By age 8, we were out there doing that. But when we were in our teens, there were a group of about 10 of us who were hired by neighborhood people who raised acres of beans for the local canning company. So our job was to handle all the pickers who came every day. And we'd have sometimes up to 400 youngsters who would come out in a day. They'd be bussed out and trucked out. And we'd need to get, you know, manage them and provide them with their bags, and we'd have numbered tags, and we'd have to supervise them, actually, in a sense, babysit with them, and then weigh them in, not the children, but the beans that they picked, and pay them out at the end of a day. So we had to really learn organizational skills in order to be able to manage that kind of operation. I've often thought it was a very important part of my learning experience. And we did that for any number of summers, probably about 4 or 5.
There were that many people that were shipped out there, bussed out there?
The maximum was 400, yes, when we'd have a lot to pick. It was a lot of little people for us to manage as teenagers, but we did it.
That's really impressive.
Yeah, it was interesting.
Yeah, now you're back. Let's start in on summer sessions here. You were back obtaining your master's degree, and in the second year you switched over to the Office of Summer Sessions. Why and how did that come about?
Well, it was really interesting. One day I was at a gift shop, and Clay Schoenfeld, whom I'd met in passing on a few occasions, came up to me and said he would like to hire me. And I said, well, have a job. I had a graduate assistantship in extension, visual arts at that time. And he said, well, you know, I'd be interested in hiring you. I didn't know why he was interested. Anyway, I remembered that. And when it seemed as though I wasn't doing the kinds of things in visual arts that I had hoped to be doing, I thought, well, I'll give him a call. And a few months had passed. Mm-hmm. So I called him and I said, this is Nancy Abraham calling, and if you're available to talk, I'd like to come and talk with you. And he said he was, so I went to his office. We were in the same building. That was kind of interesting, different parts of the building. And I walked in and sat down and said, well, if that job is still available, I'll take it. And he said, it is, and you're hired. And I had no idea what the job was. At all. So that's how I came to summer sessions, as a graduate assistant.
Well, that's really interesting. Just more or less hired off the street.
Literally, literally, because I really didn't know him as far as his personality or his working style or even what was going to be involved. And I, at that point, I really saw it as the second year of my master's program with a graduate assistantship. I didn't know it was going to stretch to 21 years.
But did you see it as possibly being something that you could do for a while initially, or did that come after
a while? That came after a while, yes. Yeah, that came after a while. But that's how it happened.
What were your first jobs when you finally learned what you were going to do?
Okay.
What did you do?
One of the first things that I, among the first things that I did, because I can't remember the exact order anymore, was a faculty load study. And that was all manual, getting data reports from payroll and from, it's part of the space management office. I can't think of the title of it now, dealing more with curriculum. And then using the timetable, so sort of using a variety of documents to begin to pull together what the faculty load looked like in summer based on the appointment level, based on salary, which was based on length of time in summer, and based on the number of courses taught. And so we did a really extensive study of that and actually continued that for several summers. And as I mentioned to you a few weeks ago, I would think by now something like that might be automated and in the database. Mm-hmm. If not, I think it should be. But so that was one of my first experiences, and it was related to summer sessions faculty and their loads.
When you worked for Clay on those early things, did he give a lot of freedom to his people?
Yes,
that
he gave very little instruction and direction.
So he more or less gave you the topic?
Yes, this is what I want. Yeah. But not with all the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6s of it, you know. It was, and how you're going to get it, that's up to you to figure out, kind of thing. You know.
Is that something that you operate well in?
Yes, yes. I'm really very comfortable with that. And I think like something like that faculty load study as an example, that's really research.
Yes, yeah, that's,
you know,
that's what
and,
I'm asking.
And so that I like that. That was no problem. I don't mean that it didn't take a lot of effort.
Right.
Because it did. But it wasn't a problem in that I was frustrated by it and wondered why we were doing it and couldn't understand it or any of those things. I mean, I could see that there would be a value in that. It's kind of hard to sell those kinds of things to other parts of the university. And certainly it was then, but we used it internally. It was a guideline for us, and Clay in particular in those years used it in looking at budget allocations. It wasn't the only aspect of budget allocation, but it was a piece of information that could be used.
So what you're saying is while you were there as an assistant, you were doing some things that were pretty relatively high-powered things, research
well,
projects.
Well, I think so.
Yeah.
You know, in retrospect, yeah. I would say yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, before we go on in that area, where was summer sessions located when you first started?
When I first started, it was located.